goes to show about your own people," said my father. As the Corinthians were not long out to sea when they decided to throw Arion overboard and seize his wealth. When he learned what was to happen, Arion persuaded them to first allow him to assume his full musician's costume and to play and sing before his death. The sailors were happy to hear the best harpist in the world and withdrew while Arion dressed himself, took up his harp, and then stood on the deck and chanted the Orthian. When he was finished, as promised, he flung himself into the sea. The Corinthians sailed away. Arion was saved by a dolphin, which took him on its back to Taenarum. A small bronze figure was made of Arion with his harp aboard a dolphin, and offerings were made to it in those times. The dolphin was moved by Orion's music. "That's how I take it anyway," my father said. I imagine the dolphin swimming alongside the ship. It heard the music and was devastated, as anyone would be imagining the emotion Orion must have put into his final song. And yet the sailors, though clearly music lovers, as they were happy to postpone Orion's death and listen, did not hesitate. They did not turn and retrieve him, but divided up his money and sailed on. One could argue that this was a much worse sin against art than drowning. Say, a painter, a sculptor, a poet, certainly a novelist. Each left behind their works, even in the most ancient of times. But a musician of those times took his art to the grave. Of course, the destruction of a contemporary musician, too, would be lesser crime, as there are always plenty of recordings. Except in the case of our Ojibwe and Métis fiddle players. The traditional player, like your uncle, Chamangwa, believed that he owed his music to the wind, and that, like the wind, his music partook of infinite changeability. A recording would cause his song to become finite. Thus, Uncle was against recorded music. He banned all recording devices in his presence. Yet, in his later years, a few people managed to copy his song as tape recorders were made small enough to conceal. But I have heard, and Whitey confirms, that when Chamangwa died, those tapes mysteriously disintegrated or were erased. And so there is no recording of Chamangwa's playing, which is as he wished. Only those who learned from him in some way replicate his music. But it has become their own, too, which is the only way for music to remain alive. "I am afraid," said my father that night, to my mother's stiffened back. The sharp bones of her shoulders pressed against the draped sheet. "I'm going to have to leave tomorrow," he said. My mother did not move. She had not spoken one word since we'd begun to eat our dinners with her. "I'm going back down to Bismarck tomorrow," my father said. "I want to meet with Gabir. He will not decline this, but I have to keep him connected. And it's good to see my old friend. We're going to get our ducks lined up, even though there isn't anyone to prosecute yet. But there will be. I am sure of that. We are finding things out little by little. And when you are ready to tell us about the file and the telephone call, we will certainly know more. I feel certain of it, Geraldine. And there will be justice. And that will help, I think. That will help you, even though you seem to believe now that it won't help you, that nothing will help you, even the tremendous love in this room. So yes, tomorrow, we won't have dinner in your room, and you can rest. I can't ask Joe to wait you out like this, to make conversation with the walls and furniture, although it is surprising where a person's thoughts go. Well, I'm in Bismarck. I'll see the governor, too. We'll have lunch and a conversation. Last time, he told me that he'd attended the governor's conference. While there, he spoke with Yelto. You know, he's still the governor of South Dakota. He found out that he's trying to adopt a child. What? My mother spoke. What? My father leaned forward, pointing like that gun dog, motionless. What? She spoke again. What child? An Indian child, my father said, trying to keep his voice normal. He rattled on. And so, of course, the governor of our state, who well understands from our conversations the reasons we have for limiting adoptions by non-Indian parents via the Indian Child Welfare Act, attempted to explain this piece of legislation to Curtis Yelto, who was very frustrated at the difficulty of adopting this child. What child? She turned in the bedclothes, a skeletal wraith, her eyes deeply fixed on my father's face. What child? What tribe? Well, actually, my father tried to keep the shock and agitation out of his voice. To be honest, the tribal background of this child hasn't been established. The governor, of course, is well known for his bigoted treatment of Indians, an image he is trying in his own way to mitigate. You know, he does these public relations stunts like sponsoring Indian schoolchildren or giving out positions in the Capitol, aides, to promising Indian high school students. But his adoption scheme blew up in his face. He had his lawyer present his case to a state judge who is attempting to pass the matter into tribal hands, as is proper. All present agree that the child looks Indian, and the governor says that she is Lakota or Dakota or Nakota, or anyway, Sioux, as the governor says. But she could be any tribe. Also that her mother, where's her mother? She had disappeared. My mother raised herself from bed, clutching the sheet around her, groping forward in her flowered cotton gown. She gave a weird howl that clapped down my spine. Then she actually got out of bed. She swayed and gripped my arm, and I stood to help her. She began to retch. Her puke was startling, bright green. She cried out again, and then crept back into the bed and lay motionless. My father didn't move except to lay a towel on the floor, and so I sat there in stillness too. All of a sudden, my mother raised her hands and waved, and pushed this way and that as if she was struggling with the air. Her arms moved with disconcerting violence, punching, blocking, pushing. She kicked and twisted. "It's over, Geraldine," my father said, terrified, trying to hush her. "It's all right now. You're safe." She slowed and then stopped. She turned to my father, staring out of the covers as out of a cave. Her eyes were black, black in her gray face. She spoke in a low, harsh voice that grew large between my ears. "I was raped, Basil." My father did not move, did not take her hand or comfort her now in any way. He seemed frozen. There is no evidence of what he did, none. My mother's voice was a croak. My father bent near. "There is, though. We went straight to the hospital. And there is your own memory. And there are other things. We have... I remember everything. Tell me." My father did not look at me because his gaze was locked with my mother's gaze. I think if he'd let go, she would have collapsed forever into silence. I shrank back and tried to be invisible. I didn't want to be there, but I knew if I moved, I'd snap the pull between them. There was a call. It was Mela. I only knew her by her family. She's hardly ever been here, just a girl, so young. She'd begun the enrollment process for her child, the father. "The father?" She listened to him. My mother whispered, "Do you remember his name?" My mother's mouth dropped open, her eyes unfocused. "Keep going, dear, keep going. What happened next?" "Mela asked to meet me at the roundhouse. She had no car. She said her life depended on it, so I went there." My father drew a sharp breath. I drove into that weedy lot, parked the car. I started out. He tackled me as I was walking up the hill, took the keys. Then he pulled out a sack. He dragged it over my head so fast. It was a light, rosy material, loose, maybe a pillowcase, but it went down so far past my shoulders I couldn't see. He tied my hands behind me, tried to get me to tell him where the file was, and I said, "There's no file." "I don't know what file he's talking about." He turned me around and marched me, held my shoulder. "Step over this, go that way," he said. He took me somewhere. "Where?" said my father. "Somewhere." "Can you say anything about where?" "Somewhere." "That's where it happened. He kept the sack on me, and he raped me. Somewhere." "Did you go uphill or downhill?" "I don't know, Basil."
"Through the woods? Did leaves brush you?"
"I don't know."
"What about the ground? Gravel? Brush? Was there a barbed wire fence?"
My mother screamed in a hoarse voice until her lungs emptied, and there was silence.
"Three classes of land meet there," my father said, his voice pulled tight with fear.
"Tribal trust, state, and fee. That's why I'm asking." "Get out of the courtroom. Get the damn hell out," my mother said. "I don't know."
"All right," said my father. "All right, keep going."
Afterward. He dragged me up to the roundhouse. It took a while to get there. Was he marching me around? I was sick. I don't remember. At the roundhouse, he untied me and pulled off the sack, and it was a pillowcase, a plain pink one. That was when I saw her, just a girl, and her baby playing in the dust. The baby put her hands up into the light falling through the chinks in the pole logs. The baby had just learned to crawl. Her arms gave out, but she made it to her mother. She was an Indian. She was an Indian girl, and I'd got the call from her. She'd come in on Friday and filed the papers. A quiet girl with such a pretty smile, pretty teeth, pink lipstick. Her hair was cut so nice. She wore a knit dress, pale purple, white shoes, and the baby was with her. I played with that baby in my office, so that's who made the call that day, her, Mela Wolfskin.
"I need that file," she said. "My life depends on that file," she said.
She was thrown on the ground. Her hands were taped up behind her. The baby crawled over the dirt floor. She was wearing a ruffled yellow dress, and her eyes, so tender, like Mela's eyes, big. Brown eyes, wide open. She saw everything, and she was confused, but she wasn't crying because her mother was right there, so she thought things were all right. But he had Mela tied up, taped up. Mela and I looked at each other. She didn't blink, just kept moving her eyes to the baby, then me, back to the baby. I knew she was saying to me, I should take care of her baby. I nodded to her. Then he came in, and he took off his pants, just kicked them off. He wore slacks. Every word sticks with me, every single word he said. The way he said things in a dead voice, then cheerful, then dead again, then amused. He said, "I am really one sick fuck. I suppose I am one of those people who just hates Indians generally, and especially for they were at odds with my folks way back. But especially my feeling is that Indian women are what he called us. I don't want to say." He screamed at Mela and said he loved her. Yet she had another man's baby. She did this to him. But he still wanted her. He still needed her. She had put him in the awkward position, he said, of loving her. "You should be crated up and thrown in the lake for what you've done to my emotions." He said, "We have no standing under the law for a good reason, and yet have continued to diminish the white man and to take his honor. I could be rich, but I'd rather have shown you, both of you, what you really are. I won't get caught," he said. "I've been boning up on law. Funny.
Laugh. He nudged me with his shoe. I know as much law as a judge.
Know any judges?
I have no fear. Things are the wrong way around, he said. But here in this place I make things the right way around for me. The strong should rule the weak, instead of the weak, the strong. It is the weak who pull down the strong, but I won't get caught. I suppose I should have sent you with your car. He suddenly turned on Mela. But honey, I couldn't. I just felt so sorry for you and my heart split wide open.
That's love, huh?
Love? I couldn't do it, but I have to, you know.
All your fucking shit's in your car.
You don't need anything where you're going. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. He struck Mela, and struck me, and struck her again and again, and turned her over. You want to tell me where the money is? The money he gave you?
Oh, you do?
Oh, you do now?
Where?
He ripped the tape away. She couldn't talk. Then she gasped out, "My car!" He could have killed her then. I think so. But the baby moved. The baby cried out and blinked, looked into his eyes without understanding. "Ah," he said. "Well, isn't that? Isn't that?"
"Don't talk no more. I don't want to hear it," he said to Mela. "You are still money in the bank," he said to the baby. "I am taking you back with me unless you, dirt." He rose and kicked me, and went over and kicked her so hard she wheezed. Then he bent over and looked into my face. He said to me, "I'm sorry. I might be having an episode. I'm not really a bad person. I didn't hurt you, did I?" He picked up the baby and said to the baby in a baby voice, "I don't know what to do with the evidence. Silly me. Maybe I should burn the evidence, you know? They're just evidence." He put her down gently. He uncapped the gas can. While he had his back turned, he was pouring the gas on Mela. I grabbed his pants and put them between my legs, and I urinated on them. That's what I did. I did. Because I'd seen him light his cigarette and put the matches back into his pocket. I was surprised that he didn't notice that the pants were wet with urine. But he was absorbed in what he meant to do. Shaking, too, he was saying, "Oh, no. Oh, no." He poured more gasoline over her and splashed gas on to me, too, but not the baby. Then, when he couldn't start the fire with the matches from his pants pocket, he turned and gave the baby a heavy look. She began to cry, and we, Mela and I, lay perfectly still as he went to comfort the baby. He said, "Shh, shh. I have another book of matches, a lighter even, down the hill. And you," he shook me and said into my face, "you, if you move an inch, I will kill this baby, and if you move an inch, I will kill Mela. You are going to die. But if you say one word, even one word up in heaven after you are dead, I will kill them both." I poured myself a bowl of cornflakes and a glass of milk. I put half the milk on the cereal, sprinkled sugar on the cereal, and ate it. I filled the bowl with cereal a second time and drank the sweet milk from the bottom of the bowl and finished off the glass. I dipped a wide-mouthed jar into the bag of dog food in the entry, filled Pearl's bowl, and gave her fresh water. Pearl stood by me as I spray-soaked the garden and the flower beds. Then I got on my bike and went to work. I saw my father before I left. He had stayed in the bedroom with my mother. He'd sat up next to her all night. I asked him about the file, and he told me that my mother wouldn't talk about it. She needed to know the baby was safe. Mela was safe. "What do you think's in that file?" I asked. "Something to work with?" "And Mela Wolfskin, what about her?" "She went to school down in South Dakota," said my father, "and she's related to your mother's friend, LaRose.
Maybe that's why your mother won't see LaRose. She's afraid of breaking down, of saying something. That's not what I meant. What about Mayla Wolfskin, Dad? Is she alive? That's the question. What do you think? Well, I think not, he said softly, looking down at the floor. I looked down at the floor, too, at the swirls of cream in the gray of the linoleum, and the darker gray and the small black spots of vertigo surprise, once you noticed. I perused that floor, memorizing the randomness. Why would he kill her, Dad? He put his head to the side, shook his head, stepped forward, and put his arms around me. He held me there, not speaking. Then he let me go and walked away. When I got to Whitey and Sonia Station, I parked my bike beside the door where I could see it. Then I started my chores. Whitey had a shortwave receiver that picked up signals all around the area. It was always crackling on and burping garbled messages in the vicinity of the garage. Sometimes he turned it off and pumped out music. I picked up all of the candy wrappers, cigarette butts, loose pull tabs, and other trash that had accumulated in the gravel gas station yard, and the weeds down to the road. I got the hose and watered yet another tractor tire flower bed, this one painted yellow, ringed with silvery sage leaves and red hot poker flowers, same as I had planted for my mother. Whitey pumped gas when customers came, checked oil, and gossiped. I washed the car windows. Sonia had bought a bun coffee maker, and Whitey had built two wooden booths in the eastern corner of the store. Sonia's first cup of coffee was a dime, and the refills were free, so the booths were always filled with people. Clements baked for the store every few days, and there was banana bread, coffee cake, oatmeal cookies in a jar, every day at lunchtime. Whitey asked if I wanted a res steak sandwich, and then he made us bologna white bread mayo sandwiches. In the afternoon, Whitey took his break, and when he came back, Sonia left to go home and take a nap. They both worked until 7 p.m. They were saving payroll for the first couple of years, just to start with. Later on, they planned on hiring a full-timer and staying open until 9. I was paid $1 an hour. Ice cream, soda, milk, and cookies off the bottom of the jar. When I got home, my father was waiting for me. How was work? It was good. My father looked at his knuckles, flexed his hand, frowned. He started talking to his hand, which was a thing that he did when he didn't want to be saying what he had to say. I had to take your mother down to Minot this morning. To the hospital. They'll keep her a couple of days. I'm going back down tomorrow. I asked if I could go, but he said there was nothing I could do. She just has to rest. She sleeps all the time. I know. He paused, then finally looked at me, a relief. She knows who it was, he said. Of course. But she still won't tell me, Joe. She has to overcome his threats. Do you have an idea? I can't say. You know that. But I should know. Is he from around here, Dad? It would fit. But he won't show up here. He knows he'll get caught. There will be someone for your mother to identify, he said, pretty soon. Not soon enough. She's going to be better once that begins. I feel certain she'll remember where, too, where it happened. The shock of telling, but then some resolution. What about Mayla Wolfskin? Did he keep her with him? And that baby? Was that the baby that the governor was trying to adopt? My father's face told me yes. But what he said was, I wish you hadn't heard all that was said, Joe. But I couldn't stop your mother. I was afraid she might stop talking. I nodded. All day my mother's words had seeped up through the surface of all I did, like a dark oil. In her right mind, she never would have described all that happened in front of you. I had to know. It's good I know, I said. But it was a poison in me. I was just beginning to feel that. I've got to go back down there tomorrow, said my father. Do you want to stay with Aunt Clements or Uncle Whitey?
I'll stay with Whitey and Sonia. That way they can bring me to work.
Next day after work, I rode back to the old place with Sonia and Whitey. We had Pearl with us. Clements was going to check in on the house and water the garden, so everything was locked up, and I didn't have to go there for a while, and that made me happy. Soon we'd have Musham's birthday. Everyone would come for that. I'd see my cousins. But for now, staying with Sonia and Whitey seemed like a vacation to me. Things could be normal at their house. I would sleep on the couch and watch television. There were different sorts of food that Whitey cooked because he'd been a professional cook. There was the wine or beer at every dinner, and the drinks after dinner, and music, noise. I didn't know how bad I needed noise. We got into Whitey's Silverado, and he immediately punched the button on the tape deck. The Rolling Stones boiled up from his subwoofers, and we drove with the windows rolled down and the wind rushing in until we took the turn off onto the gravel. Then we drove the rest of the way with the windows up against the dust. We were in a pod of noise, us three shouting over the air fan and throbbing bass. Everything was funny with Whitey. Well, as I knew, funny for about 4 hours. Funny for 6 beers or 3 shots, but for that time we laughed over the day's doings and transactions. Cappy's aunts were so savvy that they'd only put $1 worth of gas in the car at a time. It cost that much gas anyway to come and go. They each took free coffee every time. A young student from the university had come to study Grandma Thunder. She was taking her for rides every day. First, Grandma would do her errands and visit her friends and family. Then sometimes she'd let the girl take out her notebook and write down a teaching. She was having a great old time. I asked Whitey about Curtis Yelto, and he said, "You wouldn't believe the things that old boy has done and got away with. Smashed into a freight train, drunk, and lived. Used the prairie nigger word for Indians. Thought it was funny. Had a mistress in Deadeye. Bought gold and stored it in the basement of the governor's mansion, and guns. He is a gun lover slash freak. Collects war shields, Indian big word. Pays homage to the noble savage, but tried to store nuclear waste on sacred Lakota earth. Said the sun dance was a form of devil worship. That's Yelto. Oh, he's all tanned up, vain about his looks." We got to the house, and Whitey went inside to get dinner going while Sonia and I did the horse chores. As we shoveled out the barn, music blasted from the open windows of the house, and we could hear the TV babbling, too. So there was noise while we put the hay out and lightly grained the horses, and noise if we took out the moor, and noise from the dogs, anyway, as they greeted us joyously and barked to remind us to fill their dishes with food. Sonia kept the horses in the barn at night, and she checked the dogs for ticks and looked at their gums, eyes, and foot pads critically. "What you been up to today?" she'd ask each dog. She'd scold. "Not the burr patch again. You smell like you ate shit. Who the hell you let bite at your pretty tail, Chain? I'm gonna whip you if you leave this yard, you know that." Sonia spoke the same way to the horses that she put them in the stalls, and then Whitey came out and gave her a cold beer. There was a place right outside where the pasture sloped west and the grass turned golden at sunset. 2 lawn chairs were set up there, and they added one for me. I drank an orange soda, and they had a beer or 2 more, and now the music came from Whitey's boombox, set out on the steps. Then the mosquitoes whined out in attack formation, and we went inside. Whitey had traded gas for fresh walleye that day, and he cleaned the fish already. The fillets were in the refrigerator, soaking in a pie plate of milk. He whipped up a foamy beer batter. There was coleslaw made with horseradish. They always had dessert, Sonya insisted on dessert, said Whitey.
She's got a sweet tooth. Have you ever heard of raspberry fool? I made it for her from a recipe once. Or mayonnaise cake? You can't taste the mayonnaise. But she likes chocolate. She's crazy for chocolate. If I dipped my dick in chocolate, she'd never let me alone.
He got looser, of course, as the night went on and said things, and eventually Sonya put him to bed. After he was tucked in, Sonya came out and fixed up the couch for me. The couch was old and smelled of cigarettes. It was upholstered in scratchy brown stuff scattered through with tired orange nubs. Sonya tucked a sheet across the cushions and gave me a plaid sleeping bag with a broken zipper. She turned the television on, the lights out, and then she curled up on the other end of the couch. We watched TV together for an hour, or even two. We talked about the money, whispered about it because of Whitey. Sonya made me swear again and again that I had not, would not, tell anybody. I'm scared as shit. You should be too. Keep your eyes open. Don't slip up, Joe. Then we'd talk about what I should do with the money. Sonya made me promise I would go to college. She said she wanted her daughter, Murphy, to go. She named her baby Murphy because it could never be a stripper name. But her daughter had changed her name to London. If I could go back in time, said Sonya, I never would have left my daughter with my own mother when I was working. My mother had a bad influence on her granddaughter, if you can believe that. Sonya liked the talk shows, the old movies. Sometimes I fell asleep while we were watching, but before I did, I tried to suspend myself for as long as possible between sleep and wakefulness. A door might open momentarily into a dream, but instantly I'd shift back to the couch. Her soft weight on the far cushion. The warmth of her that I could feel if I edged the bare soles of my feet from under the sleeping bag, which became my favorite thing to sleep under because it disguised my hard-on. Every night, Sonya gave me a pillow off her bed. The pillow smelled of apricot shampoo and also a dusky undertone, some private erotic decay like the inside of a wilted flower. I buried my face to breathe it in. I dozed, dreamed, returning to the flickering TV light. The laugh track turned low. Sonya tranced in a blue haze, drinking cold water now. Outside, the seething of summer insects, the dogs occasionally rousing to bark once or twice at a deer far across the pasture. And Whitey, thankfully, snoring it off behind the bedroom door. The third or fourth night, when I was passing in and out of heaven, Sonya cupped my heel in her palm and squeezed it. She began absently to rub my instep, and a bolt of blind pleasure shot through me, too sudden to contain. I came with a gurgle of surprise, and she dropped my foot. A moment later, I heard a snap and sneaked a look at her. She was eating a pretzel. Whitey loved kamikaze pups. He had a wall of shelves built just the right height for grocery store samurai romances, ninja attack plots, spy thrillers, Louis L'Amour's, sci-fi, Conan. He began this morning at 6 a.m. with a cup of coffee and a paperback. As I ate beside him, he read selections aloud, murmuring. Her lithe haunches quivered with a predatory anticipation as she fixed on his position and the moonless light bereft of soul and decided exactly how to snap his spine. Ragna's dagger's sharp eye teeth glinted in the reflected beams of the headlights, knowing his life would end as soon as his eyes met that implacable obsidian gaze. If he was deeply engaged in a plot, he kept reading as Sonya set down a platter of bacon and a pan of her one breakfast specialty, a mixture of grated potatoes, eggs, diced peppers, and ham laid out in a baking pan and broiled until the cheddar cheese topping bubbled up and toasted. She called it breakfast casserole. Right after we ate, Whitey marked his page and put the book down. Sonya quickly scrubbed up the dishes. We jumped in the pickup, drove to the gas station, and unlocked the pumps. We opened at 7 a.m. There was always someone waiting for gas. That day, a couple of things happened that were not good. The first thing was Sonya's stud earrings, which Whitey said he'd never seen before. "You have too seen them," she flashed a flirty smile. The earrings sparkled in the dim kitchen. She had on yellow rubber gloves, and she was vigorously scouring the broiler pan before we took off for work. "They're rhinestones," she said. "Nice rhinestones," said Whitey. He gave an underhanded glance. Then he looked at her boldly, meanly. While she was not looking at him, her blue jeans also looked brand new and clung to her in a way that made me think of Whitey's book. Haunches quivering in deadly, etc. We got in the truck. Whitey didn't turn on the music. Halfway to town, Sonya reached over to switch on the tape player, and Whitey smacked her hand off the controls. I was sitting in the jump seat behind him. It happened right in front of me. "It's okay," said Sonya to me, over her shoulder. "Whitey's feeling low. He's hung over." Whitey's jaw was still set in that mean way. He stared straight ahead. "Yeah," he said, "hung over. Not the kind of hung over you're thinking of." Whitey had a jailhouse spit, so sleek, so accurate. Like he'd gone a period of his life with nothing to do but spit. He jumped out of the car, slammed the door, spat, hit a can, ping, and walked away, even though there was someone waiting at the gas pump. Sonya just moved over, parked, and unlocked the station. She gave me the keys to the pumps without looking outside and told me I should handle that car. This was the second bad thing. I'd seen this person. He was familiar, but I didn't know him. All of his features were neat and regular, but he was not good-looking. He was a brown-haired, sunk-eyed white man with a slack but powerful build, a big man in neat clothing, a white shirt, brown belted pants, leather lace-up shoes. His longish hair was combed back, evenly behind his ears, so you could see the tracks in it. His ears were oddly small and neat, coiled against his head. His lips were thin, dark red, like he had a fever. When he smiled, I saw his teeth were white and even, like a denture commercial. I went over to wait on him. "Fill her up," he said. I unlocked the gas tanks and pumped gas. I washed his windows and then asked if he wanted his oil checked. His car was dusty. It was an old Dodge. "Nah," his voice was genial. He began counting fives from a wad of bills. He handed over three of them. "My car was thirsty," he said. "I drove all night. Say, how are you?" Sometimes grown-ups recognize a kid and talk as if they know you. But they really know your parents or uncle, or were somebody's teacher. It is confusing. Plus, he was a customer. So I was polite and said I was fine, thanks. "Oh, that's good," he said. "I hear that you're a real good kid." I took him in now, put him together. A good kid. Second white man to say that this summer. My thought was, this could wreck me. "You know," he looked at me hard, "I wish I had a kid like you. I don't have any children." "Gee, too bad," I said, like I meant the opposite. Now I was put off. I still couldn't place him. He sighed. "Thanks. I don't know. I suppose it's luck, starting a good family and all. Having a loving family. It's pretty nice. Gives you an advantage in life. Even an Indian boy like you can have a good family and get that sort of start, I guess. And maybe it will let you draw even with a white kid of your own age, you know? Who doesn't have a loving family?" I turned to walk off. "Oh, I've said too much. Come back here." He tried to give me another five. I kept walking. He looked down and turned the ignition key. The engine coughed and caught. "Well, that's me," he called. Always saying too much. But, he slapped the side of the car.
Say what you will. You're the judge's son.
I whirled around. My twin sister had a loving Indian family, and they stuck by her when times were hard. Then he drove off. And because of what Linda had told me, I knew I had spoken with Lyndon Lark.
I decided I wanted to quit and go home now. I was mad at Whitey. I'd pumped gas for the enemy. Sonya bothered me, too. She came out of the station chewing gum, and their jaws worked, those earrings twitched and flashed. She'd spun her hair up in a flossy cone held with clips of hot pink enamel. Those jeans fit her like paint. The morning seemed to last forever. I had to stay because Whitey was gone. Then around 11 he returned, and I realized he'd had a beer, maybe two. Sonya pretended insultingly, as though she didn't notice his silence as he came and went. At noon, Sonya made us the sandwiches out of bread and meat from the cooler. So there wasn't any joking about how good our res steak was, or if I wanted mine well done. She just handed me the sandwich and a can of grape Shasta. Later on, she gave Whitey's sandwich to me. His had lettuce on it, but I ate it anyway as I watched him changing a tire for LaRose. My mother, Clements, and LaRose had been inseparable once upon a time. In Mom's little photo album, there were pictures of them in school shots at their boarding school. Mom always talked about going to school with them. LaRose figured in her stories. But when it came to the present, they didn't visit often. And when they did, it was always just the two of them talking intensely, away from other people. You would have thought they had some secret. Except that this had been going on for years. Sometimes Clements joined in, and again, they always went off, the three of them, and nobody else. LaRose was always there and not there. Even when she looked right at you and spoke, it seemed her thoughts were elsewhere, elusive. LaRose had had so many husbands that nobody kept track of her last name anymore. She had started out a Miguan. She was a skinny, fine-boned, bird-like woman who smoked brown cigarillos and wore her silky black hair in a glistening beaded flower clip. Sonya had come out to stand by LaRose. So there we were. Three pop drinkers watching a sweaty Indian Elvis try to loosen up a set of rusted lug nuts. He strained. His neck bulged. His arms inflated. His gut was padded by those nightly beers, but his arms and chest were still powerful. He sank his weight on the wrench. Nothing. He knelt back on his feet. Even the dust was hot that day. He smacked the wrench in his palm, and then he stood up suddenly and winged it into the weeds. Again he gave Sonya that crafty look. "Don't give me snake eyes, you bastard," she said. "Just because you can't turn a damn screw." LaRose raised her curved eyebrows and turned her back on the two of them. "Come on," she said to me. "I need another pack of smokes." She put her hand on my back, an auntie-like gesture. She steered me forward. We went into the store and were alone together. She reached behind the counter for what she needed. I didn't care how elusive LaRose was. I'd question her. I asked her if she was related to Mela Wolfskin. "She's my cousin." "Lots younger than me," said LaRose. "Her dad was Crow Creek." "Did you grow up with her?" LaRose lazily lit a cigarillo and snapped out the match with exaggerated wrist swipes. "What's going on?" "I just want to know." "You an FBI, Joe?" "I told that white guy with the dirty eyeglasses that Mela went to boarding school in South Dakota, then was going on to Haskell. There was this program where they took the smartest ones to have a special job in the government, something like that. Gave a stipend of money, everything. Mela got in the papers. My aunt clipped the article. Chosen for an internship. She looked so nice. Wearing a white headband. Jumper she probably made in home ec. Knee socks. I know that much. She worked for that one governor, you know. He did all those bad things. Nothing stuck to him.
Sonya walked inside and sold Laurel's the cigarillos she was already smoking. I looked outside and saw that Whitey was headed for dead Custer.
Oh, shit, said Sonya. That's no good. LaRose said, my tire.
I'll fix it. She smiled at me, the reflection of a smile. She had a sad, calm face that never really lighted up. Her delicate silken brown skin had fine lines if you were close enough to smell her signature rose powder. A silver tooth glinted when she smoked. Have a go at it, my boy. I wanted to ask her more about Mela, but not with Sonya around. First I went and found the wrench in the weeds. When I came back, I saw that the woman had brought lawn chairs and set them up in a crack of shade next to the building. They were sipping cream sodas. Go ahead, Sonya waved. Smoke drifted from her fingers. I'll take care of customers if we get any. I stared at the lug nuts. Then I got up and went into Whitey's garage and got the ratchet. Oh, said LaRose when I brought that out. Good choice, said Sonya. I got the right size socket to fit the wrench on the old nut. I poured all my strength down on the handle, but it didn't budge. From behind me, I heard Cappy, Zack, and Angus take the jump on their bikes and land by the pumps in a swirl of grit. I turned around. Sweat was dripping off me. What you got? Asked Cappy. They ignored LaRose and more elaborately Sonya. They came up to stand around the flat. Rusted out, man. They each tried the ratchet. Zack even balanced on the handle and gently bounced, but the nut seemed soldered on. Cappy asked for Sonya's lighter, applied flame. That didn't work either. You got WD-40? I showed Cappy where it was on Whitey's tool bench. Cappy squirted a tiny bit around the base and rubbed dust on the nut and inside the socket. He fit the wrench on tighter. Step on it again, he said to Angus. This time it gave, and we left the car jacked up while we rolled the tire into the garage. Whitey had a stock tank set up in there to find the holes in tires, and he was good at putting in a seal. But of course, he was over at the dead Custer. I came out and looked at Sonya. Maybe you should get him, she said, looking away, and I noticed that she'd taken out her stud earring. We got Whitey out after only three beers. LaRose got her tire fixed. We had a sudden rush, and then everything quieted down. We closed the place and got into the truck. Neither of them touched the tape deck. We rode back silently, but Sonya and Whitey just seemed tired now, all done in by the heat. At home, things went as usual. I helped Sonya with the chores. We ate, nobody saying much. Whitey drank. Morose. But Sonya stuck to 7-Up. I fell asleep on the couch with a fan blowing on me and Sonya's hair swirling gently around her profile in the sapphire light. There was a crash. The lights were out, and there was no moon. Everything was black, but the fan still stirred the air around me. In the bedroom, low vehemence, steady grating of Whitey's voice. A heavy thud. Sonya, quit that, Whitey. He give him to you? There's no he. It's just you, baby. Let me go. The crack of a slap, a cry. Don't, please. Joe's out there. Don't fucking care. Now he was calling our names one after another. I got up and went to the door. My blood pulsed and swam. The poison that was wasting in me thrilled along my nerves. I thought I'd kill Whitey. I was not afraid. Whitey! There was silence. Come out and fight me! I tried to remember what he'd taught me about blocking punches, keeping my elbows in, chin down. He finally opened the door and I jumped back with my dukes up. Sonya had put the lamp on. Whitey was wearing yellow boxer shorts patterned with hot red chili peppers. His 50s hairdo hung off his forehead in strings. He put up his hands to slick it back, and I punched him in the gut. Punch reverberated up my arm. My hand went numb. I broke it, I thought.
and was exhilarated. I swung at him again, but he pinned my arms and said, oh shit, Joe, me and Sonya. This is just between us, Joe, stay out of it. You ever hear cheating? Johnny's cheating. Some prick gave her diamond earrings.
Rhinestones, she interjected.
I know diamonds when I see 'em.
He let me go and stepped away. He tried to reclaim some dignity. He put his hands up.
I won't touch her, see? Even though some prick she's stringing along bought her diamond earrings. I won't touch her. But she's dirty.
His eyes rolled toward her, red with weeping now.
Dirty. Someone else, Joe.
But I knew that wasn't true. I knew where those earrings came from. I gave them to her, Whitey, I said.
You did?
He swayed. He had a bottle in the room.
How come you gave her earrings?
It was her birthday.
A year ago?
Asshole.
What is it to you? I found those studs in the bathroom at the gas station, and you're right. They aren't rhinestones. I think they're genuine cubic zirconiums.
Okay, Joe, he said. Fancy talk. He looked tearfully at Sonya, propped himself against the door. Then he frowned at me.
Asshole, what is it to you? He muttered.
Some way to talk to your uncle. You crossed the line, boy. He held out the hand with the bottle and pointed his middle finger at me.
You crossed a line.
Well, she's my aunt, I said. So I can give her a birthday present, asshole. He killed the bottle, threw it behind him, swelled big and leaned forward.
You got it coming, little man.
There was a splintering crack, and he sagged, his arms clutching his head. Sonya kicked him out of the doorway onto the living room floor and said, step around him. Watch the glass. You come in here, Joe. And she locked the door behind me.
Get in, she said, pointing at the bed. Go straight to sleep. I'm sitting up.
She sat down in the rocking chair and put the neck of the broken bottle carefully on the side table at her elbow. I got into the bed between the sheets. The pillow smelled like Whitey's tart hair gel, and I pushed it away and lay on my arm. Sonya turned the lights off, and I stared into the lightless air.
He could be dead out there, I said.
No, he ain't. That was an empty. Sides, I know just how hard to hit him.
Bet he says that about you, too.
She didn't answer.
Why'd you say that? She said.
Why'd you say you gave me them earrings?
Because I did.
Oh, the money. I'm not stupid. She was quiet. Then I heard her crying softly.
I wanted something nice, Joe.
See what happened?
Yeah.
Like you said, don't touch the money.
And where'd you put the earrings?
I threw them out.
No, you didn't. Those are diamonds.
But she didn't answer. She just kept rocking. The next morning, Sonya and I left early. I didn't see Whitey. He's going to walk it off in the woods, said Sonya. Don't worry. He'll be good for a long time now. But maybe you better stay with Clemens tonight. We rode to town, no music. I watched the ditches out the side window. Let me off right now, I said as we passed by Clemens's and our turnoff, because I quit.
Oh, honey, no, she said.
But she pulled over and stopped the car. Her hair was up in a ponytail, a green bow tied around it. She wore a flashy green tracksuit with white piping and spongy shoes. That day she had painted her lips a deep carmine red. I must have given her a very long, tragic look because she said, "Oh, honey, no," again. And I was thinking something of this sort. That deep red of her lips, if it were printed on me, kissed on me, would become a burning, solidified blood that would brand itself into my flesh and leave a black, seared brand shaped like the lips of a woman. I felt sorry for myself. I still loved her, worse than ever. even though she had betrayed me. Her blue eyes had a devious sheen.
Come on, she said. I'm going to need help, please.
But I got out of the car and walked up the road. The back kitchen door was open. I walked in and called out, Auntie C. She came up from the cellar with a jar of Juneberry jam and said she thought I had a job. I quit. That's lazy. You get back there. I shook my head and wouldn't look at her. Oh, they at it again? Whitey's back at it?
Yeah.
You stay here, then. You can sleep in Joseph's old room, the sewing room now. But anyway, Mushim's in Evie's room. I set up a cot for him there. He won't sleep on Evie's soft bed. That day I helped Clements out. She kept a nice garden like my mother used to. And her snap peas were in already. Uncle Edward was working on his backyard pond, trying to get the drainage and flowage just right, measuring mosquito larvae. And I helped him, too. Whitey dropped my bike off, but I never went out and saw him. We ate fried venison with mustard and browned onions. Their television was as usual in the repair shop 60 miles away, and I was sleepy. Mushim tarted off to Evie's room, and I went to Joseph's. But when I opened the door to the room and saw the sewing machine, wedged in next to the bed and the folded stacks of fabric and the wallboard with hundreds of spools of bright thread, when I saw the quilt pieces and the shoebox labeled zippers and the same heart-shaped pincushion only Mom's was dusty green, I thought of my father entering our sewing room every night and how the loneliness has seeped from under the door of the sewing room, then spread across the hall, and tried to get to my bedroom. I said to Clements, you think it would bother Mushim if I bunked with him? He talks in his sleep. I don't care. Clements opened Evie's door and asked if Mushim minded, but already was lightly snoring. Clements said it was fine, so I shut myself in the room. I shed my clothes and crawled into my grown-up cousin's bed, which was plush and saggy and smelled of dust. Mushim's snore was a very old man's hypnotizing purr. I fell immediately asleep. Sometime right after moonrise, for there was light in the room, I woke. Mushim was talking all night, so I rolled over and stuck a pillow over my head. I dozed off, but something he said hooked me in. And little by little, like a fish reeled up out of the dark, I began to surface. Mushim was not just talking in the random, disconnected way people do, blurting out scraps of dream language. He was telling a story. Aki! At first, she was just an ordinary woman, said Mushim, good at a number of things, weaving nets, snaring rabbits, skinning out and tanning hides. She liked the liver of the deer. Her name was Akikwi, Earth Woman, and like her namesake, she was solid. She had heavy bones and short, thick neck. Her husband, Miraj, appeared and disappeared. He looked at other women. She had caught him many times but stayed with him. He was a resolute hunter in spite of his ways, and the two of them were good at surviving. They could always get food for their children, and even extra meat would come their way, for she especially, Aki, could make out in dreams where to find the animals. She had a shrewd heart and an endless stare, with which she kept her children in line. Aki and her husband were never stingy, and as I say, they were always very good at finding food even in the dead of winter. That is, until the year they forced us into our boundary, the reservation year. A few had broken soil like the white man and put some seeds in the ground. But a real farm takes many years to build until it keeps you alive in winter. We hunted all the animals before the moon of Little Spirit, and there wasn't even a rabbit left. A government agent had promised supplies to tide us over for the loss of our territory.